Marin County, California, this is Democracy Now!
We are still impacted by 5 years of drought. With significant rain that we had last winter, those effects are gone of that moisture, and we are literally looking at explosive vegetation. These fires are burning actively during the day and at night when one would expect a fire to subside. And make no mistake, this is a serious, critical, catastrophic event.
As catastrophic wildfires here in California kill at least 42 people and leave thousands of homes and businesses in ruins, many of the area's 20,000 undocumented immigrants have had no sanctuary from the flames, with some sleeping on beaches in order to avoid federal agents at shelters. This comes as far-right media outlets like Breitbart are falsely reporting an undocumented immigrant was arrested in connection with the fires. Police say there's no indication the man had anything to do with the wildfires. We'll speak with the deputy county lawyer of Sonoma County and the head of the La Luz Community Center. Then as global temperatures continue to rise, we'll look at the link between fires and climate change with Dr. Max Moritz, fire research scientist based at UC Santa Barbara. And we'll host a roundtable with climate activists from Rainforest Action Network, the Indigenous Environmental Network, and 350.org on next steps after a summer of extreme weather around the world.
What the movement needs to do is be strong and unified and fight back on all of these decisions and appointments. And also, we can grow our movement. So many people who are concerned about the election of Donald Trump are concerned about what it means for this issue that is going to affect generations that have yet to come. And so we're seeing many more people who want to get involved.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're broadcasting from Northern California. Both former Presidents Barack Obama and George W. Bush criticized President Trump Thursday, slamming Trump's divisive, nativist, and hateful rhetoric. Neither of the former presidents named Trump directly, but both their speeches were clearly aimed at the current president. This is President Obama speaking in Richmond, Virginia, while campaigning for Democratic gubernatorial candidate Ralph Northam.
Instead of our politics reflecting our values, we've got politics infecting our communities. Instead of looking for ways to work together and get things done in a practical way, we've got folks who are deliberately trying to make folks angry, to demonize people who have different ideas, to get the base all riled up because it provides a short-term tactical advantage.
That was former President Barack Obama. This is former President George W. Bush also denouncing President Trump speaking at a Bush Institute event in New York.
Bigotry seems emboldened. Our politics seems more vulnerable to conspiracy theories and outright fabrication. We've seen our discourse degraded by casual cruelty. At times, it can seem like the forces pulling us apart are stronger than the forces binding us together. We've seen nationalism distorted into nativism. We've forgotten the dynamism that immigration has always brought to America.
The New York Times reports it's unprecedented in modern history for two former presidents to speak out so forcefully against the current sitting president. President Trump is planning to depart for a 12-day trip to Asia in early November amidst rising tensions between the U.S. and North Korea. Trump is slated to visit China, Vietnam, Japan, the Philippines, and South Korea. White House officials are divided over whether Trump should visit the demilitarized zone between North and South Korea during the trip, with concerns that a visit could further exacerbate the threat of nuclear war. In the Philippines, he's slated to meet with Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte, who is presiding over a bloody so-called war on drugs that has left thousands of people dead. in California. The state's insurance commissioner says the unprecedented wildfires have caused over $1 billion in insured losses. The wildfires are the deadliest since record keeping began, killing at least 42 people, destroying thousands of homes and businesses, and scorching more than 200,000 acres, roughly the size of New York City. As of Thursday, more than 20,000 people are still displaced in Sonoma County. CAL FIRE is investigating the cause of the fires. Residents in Santa Rosa have sued the Pacific Gas and Electric Company, claiming the company's failure to maintain its power lines sparked the blazes. The night the fires began, there were multiple reports of downed power lines and exploding electrical transformers. Meanwhile, the Sonoma County Sheriff has refuted false claims being spread by far right-wing news outlets, including Breitbart News, that an undocumented man arrested for arson Sunday may have sparked the blazes. Sheriff Rob Giordano said, quote, "There's a story out there. He's the arsonist for these fires. That is not the case. There is no indication he is related to these fires at all," unquote. We'll have more on the deadly wildfires after headlines. In Puerto Rico, about 3 million residents still have no electricity from the power grid, and more than 1 million people still have no clean drinking water. Now, 1 month after Hurricane Maria hit Puerto Rico as a Category 4 storm, the official death toll now stands at 48. At least 113 more people are still missing. Across the island, residents say they're suffering from eye infections and gastrointestinal diseases as a result of exposure to contaminated water. On Thursday, President Trump said his administration deserves a 10 out of 10 for its response to the ongoing humanitarian crisis in Puerto Rico. In California, the Los Angeles Police Department says it's investigating disgraced movie producer Harvey Weinstein for sexual assault. The New York Police Department and Scotland Yard are also investigating multiple reports of sexual assault by Weinstein. More than 40 women, including some of Hollywood's biggest stars, have now come forward with allegations of rape, sexual assault, or sexual harassment against Weinstein, who had been one of the most powerful men in Hollywood. One of his closest collaborators, the prominent movie director Quentin Tarantino, has now come forward to admit he knew about Weinstein's sexual harassment but did not take action because he wanted to continue making films with Weinstein. Tarantino told the New York Times, quote, "I knew enough to do more than I did. If I had done the work I should have done then, I would have had to not work with him," unquote. The U.S. Army is again facing scrutiny over sexual assault and harassment after the Washington Post reported a number of the troops and Army prosecutors tasked with preventing sexual assault have themselves been charged with rape in recent months. In September, Army Prosecutor Scott Hockenberry, who is responsible for investigating sexual assault in the military, was charged with raping a woman twice, hitting her in the face and pressing a knife against her neck. Earlier this year, another soldier certified by the Army as a sexual assault prevention officer was convicted in a military court of repeatedly raping a 12-year-old girl. The U.S. Army told the Washington Post over the last year it's launched sexual assault investigations against eight other soldiers or civilians tasked with deterring or investigating sexual assault inside the Army. In Spain, the Spanish government says it's convening an emergency cabinet meeting Saturday to trigger Article 155 of the Constitution, which will allow Spain to suspend Catalonia's autonomy and seize control of the region. The move comes after Catalonia voted to secede from Spain in a referendum Spain has called illegal. Article 155 has never been used before in Spain's modern democratic history. This is Spanish government spokesperson Iñigo Méndez de Vigo.
The president of the government has called a special cabinet meeting for next Saturday that will activate the Senate in order to protect the general interests of Spaniards, among them the citizens of Catalonia, all citizens of Catalonia, and to restore constitutional order in the autonomous region.
In Colombia, Afro-Colombian community leader José Jara Cortez has been assassinated in the southern region of Nariño. He was murdered Tuesday in a rural area where on October 5th, at least seven coca farmers were killed during clashes with police at a protest over the government's eradication of coca crops. The UN Assistant Secretary General for Human Rights has condemned the killing of human rights and land defenders in Colombia, saying, quote, the armed conflict with the FARC may be over, but the country's incredibly brave human rights defenders continue to be threatened and killed at an alarming rate, unquote. In Argentina, thousands of people marched to the Plaza de Mayo in the capital, Buenos Aires, Thursday, demanding justice and answers about the disappearance of indigenous rights activist Santiago Maldonado. On Thursday, a body was found in the river close to the site where Maldonado disappeared on August 1st during a protest against the eviction of indigenous people from lands claimed by the Italian clothing company Benetton. It's not yet known if the body is Maldonado's. Witnesses say Argentine security forces beat and arrested a person around the time of Maldonado's disappearance. The case has stoked painful memories of the military dictatorship of 1976 to 83, when U.S.-backed security forces tortured activists and disappeared an estimated 30,000 people. This is Nora Cortina of Mothers of the Plaza de Mayo.
If President Mauricio Macri wasn't interested in human rights before, Macri is president of all Argentinians now. He won with votes, not with boots. So he has to govern for all Argentinians, and Argentinians need to know that human rights are part of the government and are part of the state. So this is what we are asking, that they respect human rights.
And in North Dakota, a judge has sentenced two water protectors to jail time after they were convicted on misdemeanor charges over an October 2016 protest at Standing Rock against the Dakota Access Pipeline. 27-year-old Alexander Simon was sentenced to serve 18 days in jail for obstruction of a government function, while 64-year-old Mary Redway was sentenced to 6 days in jail for disorderly conduct. The sentences were imposed by Judge Thomas Merrick, despite the fact the prosecution had not recommended the two serve jail time. Meanwhile, journalist Sarah LaFleur-Vetter was acquitted on misdemeanor charges stemming from her reporting on the protest on October 22nd. She was filming for The Guardian at the time of her arrest. There are still hundreds of unresolved criminal cases related to the months-long resistance at Standing Rock. Three water protectors are currently imprisoned while awaiting trial: Red Fawn Fallis, Little Feather, and Dion Ortiz. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're broadcasting from the Community Media Center of Marin in San Rafael, California. Today is Community Media Day, which celebrates community media centers like this one around the country. Here in California, catastrophic wildfires have killed at least 42 people and left thousands of homes and businesses in ruins. The fires are still burning across multiple counties near where we are broadcasting from. We're in Marin, close to Sonoma County, which some say has taken the brunt of the destruction and is home to about 20,000 undocumented immigrants who've had little sanctuary from the fires. Last week, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, known as ICE, announced it would suspend non-criminal enforcement at shelters and evacuation centers here. But fear of deportation led some undocumented residents to set up camps on the beach or sleep in their cars, churches, or other pop-up shelters in order to avoid federal agents. Some evacuees also faced challenges returning to their homes because of police checkpoints. CAL FIRE is investigating the cause of the fires. Residents in Santa Rosa have sued the Pacific Gas and Electric Company, claiming the company's failure to maintain its power lines sparked the blazes. The night the fires began, there were multiple reports of downed power lines and exploding electrical transformers. This comes as far-right media outlets like Breitbart falsely reported an undocumented immigrant was arrested in connection with starting the fire. Police say they did arrest 29-year-old Jesus Fabian Gonzalez, a homeless man who'd started a fire to keep warm. Deputies extinguished the small fire before any firefighters arrived. This was after the fires had begun. But on Tuesday, Sonoma County Sheriff Rob Giordano said there is, quote, no indication Gonzalez had anything to do with these fires, and it appears highly unlikely. On Wednesday, ICE's acting director, Thomas Holman, accused Sonoma County of being a, quote, non-cooperative jurisdiction that has left their community vulnerable to dangerous individuals and preventable crimes, unquote. The Sonoma County Sheriff issued a scathing response, calling ICE's statements inaccurate, inflammatory, and damaging, and said, quote, ICE attacked the sheriff's office in the midst of the largest natural disaster this county has ever experienced. I hope to end this senseless public confrontation with these facts so that I may focus on the fire recovery, he said. Meanwhile, the fires have also contributed to an affordable housing crisis, leaving thousands homeless in neighborhoods of California where rental prices were already sky high before the blazes. For more, we're joined by two guests who work closely with the immigrant community here. Juan Hernandez III is executive director of the La Luz Center in Sonoma. And Alegria de la Cruz is chief deputy county councilor of Sonoma County, which is one of the main service providers for the large undocumented population. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Alegria de la Cruz, let's begin with you. You are the chief deputy county councilor of Sonoma County.
That's correct.
But also you have been appointed to communicate with the Spanish-speaking population here.
So as chief deputy, I actually run an infrastructure group of about 11 lawyers who serve the county's departments that do important things like parks, water, roads, et cetera. And I've also been responsible for leading the county's efforts, coordinating the county's efforts with regard to immigration service provision, as well as fundraising for legal service, increasing capacity throughout the county.
Talk about what has just taken place. This attack by, it is reminiscent of Puerto Rico in the midst of their catastrophe, President Trump attacking the San Juan mayor, who you usually saw on television with water up to her chest, holding a bullhorn, trying to evacuate people safely, and he attacked her. Now you have the head of ICE attacking Sonoma County and the sheriff who is trying to deal with the fires.
It really calls into question the public safety issues that are raised by local governments in the face of such increased efforts in terms of immigration enforcement. 2 weeks ago, we, like others throughout the county, were training immigrant communities on how to protect themselves from immigration enforcement and warning people to make sure that before they opened the doors to somebody in uniform that they saw a signed judicial warrant. And only 10, 11 days later, we're telling people, come on in for services, please, you're safe here. So the confusion and the conflict in people and in their emotional state, especially in light of this extreme natural disaster and the hundreds and thousands of people that have been impacted by this, is very difficult for the community to kind of switch so quickly. And so what we're seeing is tens of thousands of people not coming in to receive services to which they're entitled to and continuing to seek service outside of the institutions that are designed to serve them.
Where did immigrants go? Juan Hernandez.
So we heard
undocumented.
Yes, we had a large report that a lot of them have gone to, went to the coast. Doran Beach was one location that.
So they go to the ocean.
Yes, and a lot of it has to do with just functional, right? It was cleaner air. They wanted to get out to get cleaner air. But I think one of the key things that people need to understand is that communication was down completely. You could not use your cell phone. Internet was down. So communication in general was very hard to connect with people, English-speaking people, but even worse, to the Spanish-speaking people. So they had no way of communicating with anybody. All they saw was a fire coming down the hill.
And people run to the beach because they're afraid to go to the evacuation centers. They're heading to water.
Yes. So what we saw was, again, the uncertainty of where to go. A lot of our families are disconnected from services. They're disconnected from media. They're disconnected. So the point was is that they did the best they could to support their families.
So Alegria de la Cruz, when people would knock on the door, they're afraid to open it.
And this is in the face of a disaster where people are required and needing to evacuate in order to save their lives. So the county made a huge effort to ensure that information was provided in Spanish language, both written and as well as throughout the Spanish language media, really trying to send the message to folks that, okay, we've now shifted And now ICE has promised not to enforce immigration laws at these places of service provision. Please come. Please come and receive benefits for you and your family that you are legally entitled to. This is something that Sonoma County does on a regular basis as the largest service provider to the community. And so being able to kind of shift and make sure that we're continuing to do that in our capacity as the county service providers wasn't necessarily far-fetched from what it is that we do every day for people.
So respond to the head of ICE attacking your county, Sonoma County, where you are the chief deputy county counselor.
So my office does represent the sheriff's office, and I just want to kind of elevate his comments and to really highlight the fact that in the face of such disaster and such emergency, to then be responding to these kinds of attacks, I believe Sheriff Giordano said it beautifully, that these statements are inflammatory and incorrect, and making these kinds of statements at this time takes away all of the energy that we have to be fighting fires, which are still burning, making sure that people have services and are continuing to be safe. And in this time, it makes things very difficult to increase service provision to communities that are already vulnerable and in need of services, to continue to make efforts to make sure that people understand coming into shelters, coming into the local assistance center is safe, that we are there to make sure that people are receiving benefits that they need in order to recover, and that the recovery effort is equitable. These are not benefits that people are applying for illegally in any way. These are benefits to which families are legally entitled. And to be able to come into the center to receive this assistance is something that every Sonoma County resident who has been impacted by the fires has the ability and the right to do.
Can you comment on Breitbart News and others, but most importantly, the head of ICE, Holman, picking this up and accusing an undocumented immigrant of starting the fires? What is your understanding of what happened here?
The fires are still under investigation. The cause of the fires are still under investigation. It is premature at this stage, and it's very clear from the investigation that was conducted with Mr. Gonzalez's arrest that the fires could not have been caused by his small fire, which he was arrested for in the Valley of Sonoma just a few days ago, many days after the fires had already started.
Juan Hernandez, talk about the housing crisis and now people having jobs. I mean, we're here in San Rafael. It's 20, 40 miles from Santa Rosa, where you are from. Both of you, you live about five blocks apart. I mean, the images we have seen of parts of Santa Rosa right now, it's a moonscape, this now iconic picture of a mail carrier, a truck, going through a completely burned out area. How many people, about 100,000 people have been evacuated?
That's correct. Over the course of the fires, we now understand that there are still 20,000 people who have been displaced, who continue to be displaced. At the height of the fires, there were 36 shelters operating throughout the county to help folks who had needed to be evacuated either under advisory conditions or mandatorily in order to protect public safety.
The issue of affordable housing. Why?
Yeah, so before the fire started, there was the biggest issue in our county was affordable housing. And I think now this has exacerbated the issue, and it's the number one issue in our county is the housing. So now our people who have lost homes are competing with people that were looking for homes before. And so that's the number one issue that we're facing now.
So what do people do?
At this point, they're weighing their options. We know that some of our families that have been affected have been moving in with other families. The biggest issues that we're seeing that have affected our vineyard workers, our restaurant workers, our landscaper, and our hotels, number one is that loss of jobs. A lot of our families that were working in these ranches and these vineyards, some of our families, moms who are working in these cleaning houses, they have lost their ability to earn a living. The second thing is that because they haven't been working for at least a good amount of 2 weeks, they have no money. A lot of our families have been living paycheck to paycheck, and that has affected their ability to be able to get food. And so we're seeing just the basic needs of our families that are not being met. Sonoma Valley was the Springs area of Sonoma was really cut off from the rest of Santa Rosa. Highway 12 was closed, Glen Allen, that area was closed. So the Springs area was really cut off from the rest of the county. And so we had a lot of families that could not leave. And so La Luz was there, open, ready to serve these families who were not able to get out.
New York Times headline, as fires move on, wine country wonders whether immigrants will too.
That's a big question. And it has to do really more so with the housing, the lack of housing that will maybe force our families to move out of the area.
I wanted to ask what were you going to say?
I was going to say the county and the nine cities within our jurisdiction have long been dedicated to finding creative solutions to our affordable housing challenges, and we continue to be dedicated to coordinating a visioning process that ensures that whatever rebuilding and reconstruction is done with equity front and center and with affordability to really address the situation that we already were suffering and now has just been exacerbated by these fires.
Alegria, is Sonoma County a sanctuary county?
Sonoma County is not a sanctuary county. That phrase or that word is complicated. It means many things to many people. But our Board of Supervisors has long been leaders in this movement to make sure that as a county we are serving everybody who lives within our jurisdiction and making sure that folks have information and access to the people that represent them. So this idea really was developed in a series of resolution that the Board of Supervisors undertook starting really in January of this year to make sure that folks in our community knew that the Board of Supervisors and the county as a whole was there to serve them and that we were going to not only provide information in Spanish but provide culturally competent information and making sure that we were giving folks services and help in addressing their unique needs and their unique questions. Kind of mixed status families have all kinds of complicated legal questions, and the legal resources available to folks in our county at low and no cost are very, very few. So the county has been working with a public-private partnership to ensure that we fundraise to increase the capacity of our nonprofit organizations to provide increased amounts of legal services given the needs of our community.
And the significance of the ICE chief, Holman, saying that Sonoma County is non-cooperating, what does that mean?
What Sonoma County does is follow the law. There's a decision in Miranda versus Clackamas County up in Oregon that sets forth a right to people have their Fourth Amendment rights protected, and saying that ICE detainers, basically ICE sending a request to a local law enforcement agency to hold people after their time of their release, is unconstitutional, and that it actually requires a warrant to hold that person in some probable cause in order to continue to detain them. So Sonoma County, like many other jurisdictions throughout the Ninth Circuit, has followed that decision and has followed the law and respected people's constitutional rights. So while we do follow also California Truth and Trust Act, as well as the upcoming SB 54, which is California's Sanctuary Act, that will start being implemented in January. Sonoma County is just making sure that it's following the law.
Will you lose federal funding?
We have actually been part of a number of legal challenges to the Trump administration's executive orders, led by many counties and cities throughout the country, to challenge the changes in policy that we allege are unconstitutional and threaten counties' basic access to funding for law enforcement. The kind of broad unconstitutional reach of the administration's executive orders has threatened counties' basic ability to continue to receive federal funds, which make up a large amount of our budget, to ensure that people continue to be served.
Both of you, a final message, especially to the undocumented community here. I mean, for people to understand outside of this area what is happening. I mean, just talking to folks last night in San Francisco, the describe of the orange glow over San Francisco. Now, they weren't experiencing the fires. But the devastation that you're facing right now, fires still burning, though much more contained, the massive number of evacuees, the loss of people's homes, the loss of life, of course, the worst of all. But what message in particular do you have to the Latino and the undocumented communities, Juan?
So what I want to say is that this is not the first rodeo for the immigrant community being under attack either by our current president. We have been attacked since the creation of this country. So we feel that this is a resilient community. The difference now is that there's people like Alegría who are working within the county office. There's executive directors like myself who are on the same page. And we're a resilient community, and we will be here to help our community to the end. At our community level, President Trump is irrelevant.
last comment, Alegría.
We are here in a united front for our entire community. Yeah. We are one community. This recovery effort is not going to happen unless we are united, unless the recovery effort is based on equity and ensuring that everybody has their piece of this important effort to make sure that Santa Rosa and Sonoma County become whole again. Yeah.
I want to thank you both for being here. Alegría de la Cruz is Chief Deputy County Councilor of Sonoma County, hit so hard by these wildfires. And Juan Hernandez III, Executive Director of the La Luz Center in Santa Rosa.
Sonoma.
In Sonoma County. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. When we come back, we'll speak with Max Moritz, a fire research scientist with the University of California, and then we'll speak with the heads of 350.org, the Indigenous Environmental Network, and Rainforest Action Network about what they're doing now around the issues of climate change in this country and around the world. Stay with us. We're broadcasting from Northern California.
Una noche muy terrible, balazaron a un amigo mío en la calle cerca de aquí. Lo dejaron abandonado, un objeto sin vida junto a la esquina. Yo no entiendo por qué. Proteger haciendo pues los que deben proteger.
Chicano Batman performing in the Democracy Now! Studios their song La Jura, The Police, from their new album Freedom is Free. To see their full interview and performances, you can go to democracynow.org. Yes, this is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're broadcasting from the Community Media Center of Marin, the CMCM in San Rafael, California, not far from the wildfires that have devastated Northern California. As we continue our conversation about the wildfires, the deadliest since records have begun, 42 people have been killed, destroying thousands of homes and businesses. The fire has scorched more than 200,000 acres, roughly the size of New York City. Tens of thousands of evacuees have now been allowed to return to their homes, with about 15,000 still displaced as of Thursday. At least 100,000 people were forced to evacuate, with about 75,000 people still displaced. Some residents had to flee for their lives as drought conditions and powerful erratic winds contributed to the explosive spread of the fires. This is CAL FIRE Chief Ken Pinlot.
We are still impacted by 5 years of drought. With the significant rain that we had last winter, those effects are gone of that moisture, and we are literally looking at explosive vegetation. These fires are burning actively during the day and at night, when one would expect a fire to subside. And make no mistake, this is a serious, critical, catastrophic event.
Among the victims of the wildfires were elderly residents of Sonoma County, where authorities say their bodies were so charred, the only way to identify some of them was by the serial numbers on artificial joints or other medical devices.
Now officials and residents are searching for answers about the causes of this fire, as well as others that have scorched California's landscape over the past few decades. And while studies have linked wildfires to climate change, researchers say there are other contributing factors that should be considered. For more, we're joined from Santa Barbara, California, by Dr. Max Moritz, fire research scientist with the University of California Cooperative Extension, which is based at the University of California, Santa Barbara. Dr. Max Moritz, welcome to Democracy Now! Can you talk about what has happened in Northern California and how it relates to climate change, to climate chaos, global warming?
Sure. Thanks for the opportunity, Amy. As you've noted, the fires are still not even out, so we have a lot to learn. But in general, what we do know is that these were wind-driven wildfires that swept off of vegetated landscapes and entered into urban areas and then transitioned to an urban conflagration. So some aspects of why there were so many homes lost and so many fatalities are related to the vulnerabilities of this particular situation. And there are some lessons there that we will be learning about that. And other aspects of it relate to the ferocity, the strength of the fires themselves on the wildfires as they progressed across the landscape. As Ken Pimlott noted, the effects of the drought in previous years in California, we had 5 years of very severe drought. There is a lingering effect of those, even though we had ample rainfall in much of the state last year. The drought itself was made worse probably by climate change, by heightened anthropogenic greenhouse gas forced temperatures. They make the drought more severe. They basically increase evaporative demand on the plants, and basically the water content of the plants themselves is more vulnerable under those conditions, and that is a greenhouse gas-related effect. Lots of trends that we've seen over the last several decades in fire have been related back to climate change. There's been some good work looking at the temperature effects, increasing evaporative demand, but also, say, warmer springs and higher elevations causing earlier snow melt in snow-dominated forests and leading to a longer, more severe fire season. So there's pretty conclusive evidence for a link to climate change for many of the fires that we've seen in the last couple of decades, and the trends match up with what we expect from climate change and from our models. These particular events, because they were so wind-driven, it's harder to make a link to climate change, although there are ways that you would link the drought severity and possibly the flame lengths and the rates of spread while it was a wildfire. But really the losses that we saw in the urbanized environment in terms of structure losses and lives, it's really a different beast there. This is not a classic wildfire situation. This is really an urban conflagration.
And that issue of urban wildfires, of this urban conflagration, talk more about how unusual this is.
Yeah, so typically when we think about, our fire problem, we're thinking about fire on natural landscapes, whether they be forests or woodlands or grasslands or shrublands. And We sort of thought we solved the urban conflagration problem many years ago. Many cities in the earlier centuries were taken out by wildfire, and we through building codes we kind of thought we had solved some of that problem. But increasingly in the last decade, we have seen the occasional fire sweep into an urbanized area. This is not the only example, but it's clearly the most devastating. We've seen fires sweep into an urbanized area, and it manages to breach the boundary. We sometimes call this the wildland-urban interface, where naturally fire-prone landscapes abut developed neighborhoods. And we see that it's possible under extreme weather conditions, where we have hot, dry winds, that these fires can actually penetrate the boundary and then become an urban structure-to-structure conflagration. And this, so it's a very different type of fire, and it's not one that we tend to know a lot about because they're relatively rare. There have been instances, like I've said, and it appears that they're becoming a little more common. So it's clearly something that we need to plan for and learn from so that we can do things differently in the future.
Dr. Max Moritz, your research suggests that we should learn to coexist with the fires. What exactly does that mean?
Right. So fire, historically, we have had a rocky relationship with fire. Historically, we depended on fire. We used it as a tool for landscape clearing. We've used it as a cooking tool forever. But as we've developed, we've sort of handed fire over to the professionals. And we are less and less comfortable with fire, and it's more and more of a threat. When, if you look at it, there are plenty of other natural hazards that we treat quite differently. We tend to fight fire, and in between fires, we think of fighting the vegetation, in a sense. But for lots of other natural hazards, we have a different view. We sort of accommodate them, and we treat them as inevitable. So if we think about floods or landslides or earthquakes, tornadoes and hurricanes, we have a different approach to how we deal with those. And it often involves planning for them as inevitable, building them into our land use planning and our building codes. We have maps that we use for these other natural hazards. And often we avoid the most hazardous part of the landscape, and we tend to try to concentrate development on the least hazardous parts of the landscape for other natural hazards. But for fire, we tend not to do that for a variety of reasons. And so many of us have argued that it's time to take a different view towards fire and try to coexist with it as a natural and inevitable process. And I think events like this show us just how important that is. Some of the lessons, there's
and
probably
going to
be
say,
a few.
What would you say to the president of the United States, who is a climate change denier, when it comes to the issue of these wild urban fires and climate change?
Well, I think the urban fire problem is one that has a separate set of causes and lessons that come from it. But the fire problem in general, the trends that we've seen in increasing sizes and possibly intensities of fires throughout the West, there's conclusive evidence for links to climate change. There are other factors that come into play depending on where you're talking about. There's a legacy of fire suppression, and so some places are probably burning more or more intensely because of that history of putting out fires. There's some other places that have invasive species, the Great Basin and cheatgrass, bringing fire into a place that didn't have fire as often. And then humans developing the landscape and flooding it with ignitions at just the wrong times is another factor. But climate change is real, and amongst those of us studying it, modeling it, looking at the trends, we're confident that there's good evidence to support that link. And so the president is really being very naive, and the administration, by not recognizing this as real. And I think worse than that in the fire context, or on top of that, is that it appears that the administration's one of the administration's key solutions to this would be to log our way out of the problem. And very few people studying fire or forest management, very few of us doing research in this area believe that timber harvesting, which has a certain set of goals and methods, that equates to fire hazard reduction. There's very big differences between the way you would go about managing an ecosystem for fire hazard reduction and commercial timber harvest. So this idea that we can, through logging, somehow address our fire problem is very backwards and very outdated.
Dr. Max Moritz, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Fire research scientist with the University of California Cooperative Extension. He's based at University of California, Santa Barbara. We're north. We're in Marin County. We're near the fires in Northern California. When we come back, we'll talk with environmental leaders about what to do about climate change and where they're focusing their organizations. Stay with us.
Someone to come around and show you love. Had so many come around and take away. Never had someone to come around and build you up. In essence, killing you. Nothing's real to you. No one's feeling you. To come in, healing you. You don't need no one. You've gotta love yourself. Cause when you get real love, won't need nobody else. Say, I gotta love me. Say, I gotta trust me. Say, I gotta give myself surprise. Say, I gotta love me. You have had someone that comes and breaks you down. Never had someone to come and make you smile. You just need someone to come and show you love. You just need someone to come and build you up. Build you up. Build you up. Build you up.
Build You Up by Kamaya here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodwin. We're broadcasting from the Community Media Center of Marin here in San Rafael, California. Today is Community Media Day, which celebrates community media centers like this one around the country. So we are proud to broadcast from here to 1,400 public television and radio stations around the United States and around the world. We end today's show with a roundtable discussion on what the environmental movement is focusing on now. We're joined by three guests. Lindsay Allen is executive director of the Rainforest Action Network. Dallas Goldtooth is an organizer with the Indigenous Environmental Network. And Mae Bouvy is executive director of 350 Action, the political arm of the climate organization 350.org. We welcome you all to Democracy Now! Mae, I want to begin with you because your family's from Sonoma. Talk about how you've been affected and what 350.org is doing right now.
Well, thank you, Amy, and it's really nice to be here with this group this morning. And Sonoma is the place I love most in the world, and I honestly didn't think this kind of thing was ever going to happen there. And I think about climate disasters a lot, but I'm very happy that my family is safe. But they and a lot of other people in Sonoma, Santa Rosa, and Napa have joined the growing community of people around the world who are living through the worst impacts of climate change. And we knew this would happen. We saw this coming, but our political system has been far too slow to respond. And again, I'm just very grateful that my family is okay, but I, my heart really goes out to this place and this people who shaped who I am.
And so what is 350.org doing about climate change? What is the message? You just sent out an email a day or two ago, an urgent plea and demand.
Well, the good news is we know how to stop this problem, and we've known it for a long time, that this thing that's standing in the way of action on climate change isn't that we don't know what the solution is. We actually do know what the solution is, and we know exactly who's standing in the way, which is the fossil fuel sector. But community groups on the ground all over the world have been effective at stopping coal projects, at stopping pipelines, at getting their communities to go 100% renewable energy. And we just need more of it. And that's what we're focused on across our global network. And we believe that this is what we need to do. We just have to do it quickly because the impacts are happening in a cascade of speed.
Lindsay Allen, you just celebrated another year of Rainforest Action Network. Talk about what your group is doing, how it started, and what it's focused on now, Rainforest Action Network.
Yes. We started 30 years ago looking at how we could ensure that consumers were having less of a negative impact on rainforests, even if they were removed and they weren't directly located there. So we found that that Burger King was leading to deforestation in the Amazon rainforest. People started showing up and protesting Burger King.
They canceled.
Burger King was one of the companies, when we followed the money, when we followed the products, we knew that beef from the Amazon rainforest was going into hamburgers. And so people started protesting outside of Burger King.
Because the cattle in the rainforest.
Exactly. The cattle in the rainforest, in order to have areas to graze, they were clearing and burning rainforests. And the Amazon, as we know, it's the lungs of the earth. So there's no reason to do that. That created our model where we really challenged the role that companies are having on environment, on communities. And now what we're really looking at is drawing the connection. We work at this intersection between human rights, climate change, and deforestation, because it's all connected. We know that deforestation leads to climate change. We know that forests can help us buffer against increased emissions that are coming from the burning of fossil fuels. And we also know that the burning and clearing of forests makes climate change worse. So we continue to follow the money. We have found that big banks are willing to finance 6 degrees of climate change. And we need them to be on a 1.5-degree trajectory for the world. So what we're seeing is all around the world, people are going to banks and saying this is unacceptable. Just for the past couple years, we've been working with Friends of the Earth France and with a local group in the Gulf called Save the Rio Grande Valley from LNG. And they're working to stop the more than 60 liquefied natural gas export terminals that would allow fracked gas to make its way out of the U.S. into global markets, to make climate change worse, to make community health worse where fracking is happening. When we partnered with them, we said, who are the banks that are financing these massive projects? And we found that one of them was the largest bank in France, BNP Paribas. So actually, the morning that I woke last week to, you know, hearing all the alerts, stay indoors, the smoke is terrible because of the fires around here, I also got an alert that said BNP was committing to the strongest fossil fuel policy we've seen from a big bank. They have cut ties with tar sands oil. They've cut ties with coal mining and coal power, with fracking, and with the very fracked gas export terminals that we've been working on with partners in the Gulf Coast.
Explain what BNP is.
BNP is the second largest bank in Europe. It's called BNP Paribas. Locally, if you're familiar with Bank of the West, it's connected. BNP Paribas is their parent company. They're actually the eighth largest bank in the world.
Dallas Goldtooth, you're with Indigenous Environmental Network. You spent a lot of time in the last year at Standing Rock. As this year, at this moment, we are seeing the largest number of hurricanes ever in recorded history in this country. I think the number is up to 10. The last one named was Ophelia, which hurtled the furthest east in the Atlantic than we'd ever seen and hit Ireland. You were participating in the protests a year ago, warning about the catastrophic effects of climate change. You were participating in those protests at Standing Rock, North Dakota, where Indigenous people and their non-Native allies are continuing to go to court for their protests.
It's absurd that we're facing this time of extreme climate chaos. You have fires, you have the hurricanes, you have flooding all across this world, and yet mainstream society, mainstream news is not making the connection between these extreme events and climate change. I think for those of us in many of the communities that the Indigenous Environmental Network works with, who are on the front lines of these fights, realize the extreme dangers of climate change, because it's literally threatening the lives of a lot of Indigenous people, forest-dependent peoples, ocean-dependent peoples. And it's time for us to really wake up and really make some significant changes that some of the other organizations here have talked about and the work that IEN does. And, you know, Indigenous peoples have often been at the forefront of these struggles, not only just to protect the environment, protect the land, but protect our right to have a sacred relationship with Mother Earth itself, and to protect our right to self-determination. And, you know, whether it's you're talking about the hurricanes in the Gulf Coast, or you're talking about sea level rise up in Alaska, or you're even talking about pipelines, or even the fires here in Northern California, it's oftentimes Indigenous peoples in those communities, in those areas, who are also carrying a significant amount of weight.
Talk about the land we're on right now.
Yeah, we're in Marin County. This is traditional Pomo and Miwok territory lands, and in the Ohlone tribes as well. And just north of us in Santa Rosa, California, which just got decimated by a massive fire, the Kashaya Pomo tribe is in that area, and a lot of tribal members themselves have been displaced from their own lands and their own territories because of fires. You know, it's connected to people that are in the Gulf Coast who got hit by the hurricanes down, whether in Texas or in Louisiana, you know, feeling that same, those same emotions and that same tragic, the loss, and really saying this has to stop, but we don't know how to do it. And I think that that's where the organizations that we work with and the communities that I work with are really raising the alarms about climate change are essential. And I think that, you know, it goes without saying that oftentimes it's indigenous peoples and communities of color that carry the brunt of a lot of this climate chaos in a very unfair way.
When Hurricane Harvey had devastated Houston, this was September 6th, and Irma was hurtling toward the United States, already devastating parts of the Caribbean. President Trump went to Mandan, North Dakota, to give a speech. He stood in front of an oil refinery. He was down the road where hundreds of indigenous people had been jailed at the Mandan jail and gone through the Mandan courthouse. And he talked about, well, he basically boasted about pulling the U.S. out of the climate accord. And he talked about how proud he was that they green-lighted the Dakota Access Pipeline and the Keystone XL Pipeline. Where do the indigenous people who are going to court today stand in Mandan?
Well, you know, what we saw in Standing Rock was the largest mobilization of indigenous resistance in living memory for a lot of our communities in North America. And, you know, we became at some point the camps, the Cheti Shakoin camps and the Sacred Stone camps. We, at one point, were the sixth largest city in North Dakota. And that's amazing to see the allyship and the people that came. And to this date, there have been over 700 arrests, including, I know that you are also a part of that the arrest as well.
Yeah, a year ago this week, the charges were dropped as the Democracy Now! Team went to there on Labor Day to cover the protest. And I was arrested for our team filming.
And I think that what we're seeing right now is just yesterday there was a really absurd conviction that happened where actually they had to pull. There's so many cases happening right in North Dakota that they're actually pulling judges out of retirement to handle some of the caseload. And one of the judges just yesterday convicted two of our water protectors to some time in jail, even though the state, the prosecutors, asked for them not to be convicted. So we're seeing an unfair court system in place in North Dakota that is persecuting water protectors whose only reason for being there is to protect water and to protect indigenous communities' right to self-determine what happens to their lands and communities and bodies. And it's really absurd that we're in that position now. And it makes sense because it's kind of this trickle down. If you have a tyrant in the White House who is blind and who is willingly blind to the effects of climate change and the effects of the fossil fuel industry has on the land, it's going to trickle down.
You're all involved in these bank protests. And I'm wondering, May, very quickly in this last seconds we have left, where you're focusing now.
In the bank's work, we're still focused on fossil fuel divestment. We've seen $5 trillion in assets under management made fossil free. We just had a huge divestment announcement from the Catholic Church and a series of institutions, including where Pope Francis is from. So the momentum is enormous. And the financial sector is very sensitive to this kind of pressure. So that's what I'm really glad we're working together on.
And the evidence of that, Lindsay?
Yeah, we're going after JP Morgan Chase. We know that they are the number one financier of the most extreme fossil fuels. Every year we do a report card. Many big banks are decreasing their investments in fossil fuels, and they're increasing.
Dallas.
And folks can be a part of this divestment campaign. On Monday, actually, it's going to be Divest the Globe. They can go to mazascatalks.org. You can check out IEN Earth's website for more information. But we're doing a massive global divestment campaign that's ongoing.
Well, we're going to leave it there. I want to thank you all for being with us. Lindsay Allen, Executive Director of Rainforest Action Network, Dallas Goldtooth, organizer with Indigenous Environmental Network, and May Bouvy, Executive Director of 350 Action. And that does it for our show. We've broadcasted from San Rafael, California. I'll be speaking at Marin Prince Center at the Bioneers Conference tomorrow, 9:30 and 4:30. Today, Juan Gonzalez speaks at noon at Princeton University. Special thanks to our crew here at the Community Media Center of Marin, Damian Brown, Michael Eisenmaker, Jill Lazard, Megan Loretz, Ginger Saunders Mason. Thanks so much. I'm Amy Goodman for joining us.